We have a lot of news for you on the Lori Vallow front, including the prosecution's response to the notice of alibi. Some of the University of Idaho victims' families are concerned about the demolition of the house where the killings took place before the trial. It'll be okay. We have a Stephen Smith update. Did you get your Murdoch memorabilia? A Mother of the Year contestant pled not guilty to her son's death. Aiden Fucci is sentenced. And then finally, our dumb criminal of the day. Let's talk about it. Good day, everyone. My name is Scott Reich, and this is Crime Talk. Let's get to it. First, you know the drill. Subscribe if you haven't. Like it if you do. Hit that little notification bell and leave me a comment below. And remember, you can listen to us on any of your favorite podcasting apps. Also, support the people that help keep the lights on here. Go to crimetalksearch.com. Sign up for that background subscription service. When you sign up, guess what? You can cancel at any time. But while you have that subscription, you can do one search or you can do 100 searches. That's up to you. But literally when you do that search, you type in the individual's name and a report is literally generated while you wait. It is emailed to you. You can download it. You can do with it what you choose. But it's going to have relevant information. Does somebody have a criminal history? Does somebody have some bankruptcies in their history? Are they married? Are they divorced? Are they telling you what they, is it true what they're telling you? You need to check them out. Trust but verify. Go to crimetalksearch.com. All right, let's go ahead and begin the docket for March 24th, 2023. And let's open the record. First, a lot of news as it relates to the Lori Vallow matter. As you know, trial is supposed to begin in the first week in April. How exciting. We've only waited 3 years for this. And there's been some recent filings. I want to explain a couple of things. First, so the prosecutors filed a response to defendant Lori Vallow's notice of alibi, which they acknowledge was given more than 10 days before the trial commences. That's fair. And they go through and say, oh yeah, the defendants was indicted back in May 25th of 2021. That's right. So they've had at least 2 years to deal with that. And the defense basically responded to the discovery request by the prosecution. And they said that a written notice of defendant's intentions to offer defensive alibi stating the specific place or location where the defendant was when the alleged offense took place. And the prosecution cites a bunch of Idaho code. And they note that the defendant's case was stayed as a result of competency issues, but that that stay was listed on April 11th of 2022, and then she was arraigned on April 19th. The defendant did not provide her notice of alibi until January 5th of 2023. So what, state? The state then goes on to explain that all previously disclosed evidence establishes the defendant's participation in the charged crime, murder, conspiracy, and grand theft. As the alibi goes, they does not apply to the conspiracy charge. The alibi disclosure is misplaced as it relates to those charges. Any alibi is similarly misplaced in charges where the defendant is charged with murder as the principal. Okay, what does this really mean? I mean, that's a whole lot of a nothing burger, so to speak. Really, an alibi is saying, I didn't do it. It is in addition to a general denial, which is, I didn't do it. The general denial to the conspiracy charges, there was no conspiracy. I did not participate in that conspiracy. An alibi is saying somebody else committed the crime, which is what the defense has said. Alex Cox was, in fact, the person that committed the crime. Didn't know he was going to do it, didn't encourage him, didn't aid him in any way. So I'm not sure why the prosecution is like, it's like that annoying little kid that always wants to raise their hand at school and let somebody know that they got something wrong. Listen, Lori Vallow has some very experienced attorneys. I think they know that it doesn't necessarily apply as it relates to the conspiracy. They've already entered a general denial. I don't know. I'm hoping the prosecution gets this right, okay? Normally, what you think is going to take place at trial takes place at trial. but I'm not getting that warm, fuzzy feeling. And like I said, I feel like it's literally like that annoying kid, the gunner, you know, the one that always puts his hands up to let everybody know how smart they are. Why? This is just a wasted pleading, just saying. And here I am talking about it. I don't know. Anyway, the prosecution then goes on and says that, hey, we're going to call witnesses to rebut this alibi claim of Melanie Gibb, Melanie Pulaski, David Warwick, Apple Business Records, Google Business Records, Sean Derrick, Blue Sky Property Business Records, Zulima Pastenis, Ron Ball, David Stubbs, and Ray Hermosilla. So there you go. They're going to basically say they're going to call their witnesses to say that she already knew something about it. Didn't need a response. Okay. I mean, is the defense supposed to be intimidated? I'm assuming they're going to expect that to take place. All right. So a couple of other rulings were released to the public. Of course, you never know what else is being done behind the scenes. The first one, the motion in limine. The prosecution sought to limit the defense raising conditions of mental health at trial because that deadline has passed and it was due. We've already talked about this. The prosecution has litigated this and the court has finally said, hey, the defense was only going to raise this at a sentencing phase if necessary. But since the prosecution screwed this case up so bad and now the death penalty doesn't apply, the defense is not going to call any mental health witnesses at all. And the defense wanted a guy by the name of Michael Wellner prohibited from testifying. And the DA said, well, they're not going to call Mr. Wellner to testify. So that whole issue is moot. The court is allowing in certified records from Arizona to be permitted to be admissible under the business records exception. Then there's this Astria report, supposedly written by some guy by the name of Dr. Green. And the report was apparently received by February 23rd. The late timing is attributable to a dispute over consumptive DNA testing, apparently, the court notes. And any prejudice is speculative to the court, and the results will not be done prior to trial. That's interesting. But since Lori Vallow has insisted on trial beginning as scheduled, that risk is basically borne by the defense, knowing in advance of trial that the outstanding DNA could have materially affected her case. Either way, the report's coming in and the unknown results may be coming in. We'll see if they're favorable to the defense or favorable to the prosecution. I kind of like this, though. Don't you like it? Like, let's get your trial. I mean, prosecution had 3 years ready to go. The results on some DNA is not even going to be done until the start of trial. Are you kidding me? The biggest trial in Idaho, other than maybe the Koberger case, at least that I can remember. Are you kidding me? And they're not prepared. Unbelievable. Because remember, ladies and gentlemen, that stuff just doesn't miraculously come into evidence. You got to bring in the people that cut the little DNA out, that basically did the preliminary testing, the people that did the results, and guess what? You got to get them all there to the courtroom. You think the prosecution is going to be able to get all that done? Okay. I had a trial about this time last year on a real bad shooting, attempted murder, firing guns down the street, etc. The prosecution, a little stunned that they didn't have all their witnesses there that they needed, and we shut them down hard. Needless to say, my client was found not guilty of 4 counts of attempted murder and was found guilty of a couple of misdemeanors. Yeah. We'll see if the prosecution can pull their act together for sure. Anyway, the parties have also submitted some standard jury instructions, but I think it's these are the jury instructions that are kind of at issue. Obviously, you have the preliminary jury instructions, proof, etc. How do you justify, how do you consider the testimony of witnesses and what have you? But here's the conspiracy jury instruction that the prosecution is proposing. First, in order for the defendant to be guilty of conspiracy, the state must prove each of the following. That on or about October 16th of 2018 to January 15th of 2020, in the state of Idaho, the defendant, Lori Noreen Vallow, with Chad Daybell and Alex Cox, agreed to commit the crimes of murder in the first degree of Tylee Ryan and grand theft by deception. The defendant intended that at least one of the crimes would be committed. One of the parties to the agreement performed at least one of the following acts. And they go through that on or about October 18th, 2018 and June 9th, 2020, Jad Guy Daybell and Lori Vallow did endorse and espouse religious beliefs for the purpose of encouraging and or justifying the homicide of Tylee Ryan. On or about August 16, 2019, Lori Vallow did change the deposit of Tylee Ryan's Social Security benefits from Tylee Ryan's J.P. Morgan Chase account to deposit money directly into Lori Noreen Vallow's personal BBVA account. Then on or about September 1st of 2019, Lori Noreen Vallow did move from Chandler, Arizona to Rexburg, Idaho with Alex Cox, Tylee Ryan, and Joshua J.J. Vallow. Then on or about September 8th, 2019, Chad Guy Daybell Googled SSW Wind and visited a website. What is the definition of SSW Wind Direction? On or about September 9th, 2019, Alex Cox did go to 565 Pioneer Road, Apartment 175, Rexburg, Idaho. On or between September 9th, 2019 and February 1st, 2020, Lori Noreen Vallow failed or refused to contact the Social Security Administration as required by law to inform the Social Security Administration of Tylee Ryan's death. And on or between September 25th, 2019 and January 22, 2020, Lori Noreen Vallow did wrongfully continue to collect 5 monthly Social Security survivor benefits. That's the conspiracy charge. Malice aforethought, on or about, in order for the defendant to be guilty of first-degree murder with malice aforethought, the state must prove the following. On or about between September 8, 2019 and September 9, 2019, in the state of Idaho, the defendant, Lori Noreen Vallow Daybell, engaged in conduct or did aid, abet, advise, counsel, or procure another to engage in the conduct which caused the death of Tylee Ryan. The defendant acted without justification or excuse, with malice aforethought, and the murder was a willful, deliberate, and premeditated killing. Premeditated means to consider beforehand whether to kill or not to kill, and then decide to kill. There does not have to be an appreciable period of time between which the decision to kill was considered, as long as it was reflected upon before the decision was made. A mere unconsidered and rash impulse, even though it included intent to kill, is not premeditation. And then they go through a couple more instructions, but that's the gist of it. But what can we see? It seems like even the prosecution concedes neither Lori Vallow nor Chad Daybell actually committed the deaths of JJ and Tylee, that they were either complicit or conspiring with Alex Cox, who is the actual murderer. So if the defense can show that there was no conspiracy, and remember, a conspiracy is nothing more than an agreement between two or more people to commit an illegal act, and you're in that conspiracy unless and until you're withdrawn. The prosecution, however, is going to have to show that there was, in fact, a conspiracy. Is this in text messages? And remember, the prosecution has to establish by a preponderance of the evidence that there was in fact a conspiracy before statements of co-conspirators come in. It's going to be interesting to see if the prosecution can do this to lay the appropriate foundation. What evidence do they really have? Is there a direct witness that said, oh, I was there, the agreement was made for JJ and Tylee to be murdered? I doubt that. Neither Alex nor Chad will be there to testify, obviously. So it's going to be interesting for the prosecution to do this. And I understand the defense keeps saying Lori Vallow won't waive her right to speedy trial. But I think old Mr. Archibald, he knows exactly what he's doing. And frankly, it's worked to his benefit thus far. Like I said, I hope the prosecution gets their act together. They got a lot of work to do, and they don't have a whole lot of time to do it. Oh, the other order that I wanted to talk about was, just like I told you, the court noted that after Judge Boyce had said that there was not going to be a death penalty for Lori Vallow, the state said they wanted to submit additional evidence. And in fact, they filed a motion to submit additional evidence in support of the death penalty, which is a fancy word for motion to reconsider. Denied. And the court noted that, well, it was late. So the public also does not get to see the juror questionnaires. Now, I understand we wouldn't get to see the juror questionnaires as completed, but what is the big secret as it relates to the juror questionnaires? Most of the juror questionnaires that I've ever dealt with are usually 1 to 2 pages, front and back, and they simply ask, you know, here's your information, is there anything about this case, why you could not be a fair juror? And then you talk to the jurors individually if they put something on their questionnaire that basically says they can't be fair and impartial. If it's so obvious, you just excuse them. If there's something, a little bit of gray area, maybe a little explanation is warranted, then you keep them there for the general veneer panel. But I don't understand what the big secret is as it relates to the juror questionnaire. Most jurisdictions have a standard juror questionnaire. And what does it matter what we know about the juror questionnaires? I don't think it matters at all. But hey, it's Idaho. Everything's done in secret. We also don't get to see the state's exhibit list or their witness list. Usually these are public filings. And you can go down and do it. I've never seen a witness list or an exhibit list basically not be made to the public when it's filed with the court. It's an open record. Just very odd to me. Like I said, this is usually all public record information. Anyway, a lot of stuff going on. It's going to get busy in the Lori Vallow case. Next, the Brian Koberger matter. Some of the University of Idaho victims' family members are concerned about the demolition of the house where the killings took place before, that would be destroyed before his trial. The family's concerned that if the jury wanted to visit the crime scene, they'd no longer be able to do so. No, I assure you, that house has been thoroughly photographed, measured, gone through with video cameras thoroughly. Everything has been thoroughly documented. And the defense even had an opportunity to go and inspect the scene. Jurors generally have no right to go to the crime scene. The evidence will be thoroughly explained through photos, videos, and demonstrative drawings. And I guarantee you, the jurors will know that house like the back of their hand by the time the trial is over, assuming it goes to trial. So for those who aren't familiar, obviously, the Idaho murders, where Brian Koberger is the suspect, although we'll give him the presumption of innocence. The homeowners gifted the house to the University of Idaho with the intent that it would be demolished. Next, did you get your Alec Murdoch memorabilia? That's right. We brought you the news the other day about Alec Murdoch's property going up for auction, his personal property. Well, those items belonging to Alex Murdoch went up for auction Thursday, just weeks after the charged murderer was convicted of killing Paul and Maggie. And many of those items that came under the auctioneer's hammer come from the South Carolina Hunting Lodge, where obviously Murdoch committed the brutal murders. Some of the items included, well, lots of boxes of shotgun shells, a lot of hunting shirts, and there's even a shirt marked with Alex inside the collar. Also up for auction is furniture from the house, some decoy ducks, some weird-looking lamps made from turtle shells, and even a decorative skull. The warehouse where the auction was actually held had rows of possessions laid out across long tables as prospective bidders sorted through the items that once filled the Moselle estate. Now, the Moselle estate sold Wednesday for $2.6 million, with proceeds from the sale reportedly going to Alex Murdoch's outstanding legal bills, the Palmetto State Bank, Buster Murdoch, and victims of the infamous 2019 boat crash. We brought you that breakdown last week. Now, I remember it was originally going to be sold for like $3.6 million. Now it's coming in for a little less than that, for $2.6 million. Wow. If I had known it was $2.6 million, maybe I would have got into the bidding on that. That property is great. It's got its own little landing strip, a hangar, a house. Sure, I mean, a couple of murders have taken place there, but people die all the time. And as we know, just lead just gets the hose out, or the Murdoch brothers got the hose out, cleaned up that whole mess completely. Anyway, the new owners of the property, I'm not going to give you their names, but they decided to clear the house out after they purchased it and put all the contents up for auction. Among the more expensive items on sale were lamps emblazoned with turtle shells, which sold for $800, a Yeti tumbler for $400, and mounted longhorns, which were given a price tag of $10,000. The first item auctioned off was an animal trap that went for $500, which was followed by a pair of rocking chairs for $850. And then the couch from the family room fetched $30,000. Now, I don't know if that was jacked up high because it was an auction. Someone's going to say, hey, this was the couch that Alec Murdoch took a nap on right before he killed his wife and son. Or maybe it was just really high quality stuff, because let's face it, Alec Murdoch was blowing a lot of money, and it's really easy to spend other people's money or money from a theft. So let me know if you Anyone there out there got their memorabilia? And if what are they going to do with it? Are they going to put up on one of those weird, creepy websites where they put up like serial killers' stuff, like, you know, block of hair or something? Weird. Let me know. Anyway, Stephen Smith, apparently a rape kit was ordered in the hours after Stephen Smith's body was found lying dead in the middle of the county road. The 19-year-old was initially believed to have been killed in a hit and run on or about July 8th, 2015. But this week it was announced that the South Carolina Law Enforcement Division, aka SLED, was investigating his death as a murder. Now, Michael Duncan, a former South Carolina Highway Patrol supervisor, told reports that the rape kit was ordered within 13 hours of Smith's death, something he had never encountered in his years investigating a fatal traffic accident. As you may recall, earlier this week, in fact, Monday, example, Mr. Murdoch, Buster Murdoch, denied vicious rumors about his alleged involvement in his classmate's death. And obviously, there's been several high-profile documentaries by HBO and Netflix that aired claims that the pair were allegedly linked romantically. Stephen Smith's mother, Sandy, implicated Buster in her death in a 2016 letter to the FBI, which resurfaced this week, resurfacing to gossip that Buster Murdoch, who graduated with Stephen, beat Stephen to death with a baseball bat. Now, Highway Patrol Officer Duncan said Smith's wounds were inconsistent with a traffic accident, and the local Sheriff's Department and Highway Patrol police officers informed SLED they believe the death should be investigated as a homicide. However, a subsequent autopsy by a pathologist in Charleston found that Smith's head wound was caused by blunt force trauma consistent with a vehicular collision or some other blunt force object, perhaps, like a bat. When the results were returned, Highway Patrol did not want to take the case, insisting that SLED should be following up with a homicide probe. The family attorney confirmed that a rape kit had been ordered, and it's not clear what the results were or if the test was actually conducted or the results tested as of yet. Next on the docket, a Mother of the Year contestant appears in court and says not guilty. Quentin Simon, remember this case? Yeah, the mom appeared in court. Lalani Simon, accused of killing her toddler son and tossing his body into a dumpster, was arraigned yesterday on 19 counts, including 3 counts of murder, and ordered held without bond at a hearing in Savannah, Georgia. Now, Lalani Simon was arrested on November 21st, 6 weeks after she reported her 22-month-old Quentin Simon missing and tried to blame the father for his disappearance. Lalani then reportedly changed her story about the night little Quentin disappeared multiple times by a lengthy search for the boy, which ended on November 18th. Well, it ended because investigators found his remains in a landfill. Police actually had to comb through 1.2 million pounds of garbage to find the young boy. Well, the judge handling this case, a judge by the name of Tammy Stokes, ruled that cameras could film the proceedings to be paid back later over the objection of both the prosecution and the defense, and she had previously barred live streaming of the proceedings. The judge also heard arguments from Simon's team, which consisted of 3 public defenders, stating that she should receive a bond. The attorneys argued that Simon was not a flight risk because she had remained in Chatham County, even though law enforcement had called her a suspect in Quentin's death, and that she wanted to be reunited with her other 2 children, a 9-month-old girl and a 4-year-old boy. Yeah, that'd be a bad move. Well, the state's response was a 9-page pre-filed document arguing the complete obvious. Needless to say, judge ultimately agreed with the prosecution, and Miss Simons will remain in custody pending her trial. An argument often made is the fact that, judge, they didn't leave the state. Well, things are a lot different when you've actually been charged and reality hits in that someone's actually looking at spending the rest of their life in prison. That's why they become a flight risk. And the facts are pretty aggravating when it's pretty clear that she obviously lied, tried to blame the father of the child who wasn't even around, was in literally a different county, and then she was off partying with her mom while the police were out there looking for a kid. You think if it was truly a situation where she was concerned for locating her child, she would have been out there with the police looking as well. But she wasn't. Well, Lalani, or Miss Simon's attorneys also asked that the arraignment be postponed, another request that the judge denied. The defendant entered a not guilty plea, and her attorneys requested a trial by jury. Aiden Fucci, got sentenced today. He's now 16. Well, and he stabbed a 13-year-old cheerleader, a schoolmate, Tristan Bailey, 114 times. Well, he's been sentenced to life in prison after being condemned for his twisted desire to find out what it felt like to kill. That's right, 14-year-old kid. Anyway, Fucci was 14 at the time, pled guilty to first-degree murder, admitting to the stabbing, which took place at the end of the cul-de-sac in a quiet little neighborhood there in St. John's, Florida. Because he's a juvenile, the Florida teen is not eligible for the death penalty and has 30 days to appeal the judge's decision, which there's nothing to appeal. He'll also be able to have his sentence reviewed within 25 years. Nope, not old enough. When people commit violent crimes, they basically need to go to prison so that they're so old they could never, in this particular case, hold a knife or pull a trigger finger. They need to be geriatric when they get out. The court noted that Tristan Bailey was conscious, aware, and doing everything she could to fend off this attack, the court noted. And the court also noted that she suffered a painful, horrifying death by someone that she trusted. The judge revealed his sentence this morning and said there was only one appropriate sentence in this case before sharing the ruling, obviously of life without parole. The judge noted that Fucci's age, mental health, home life, and letters from the boy's family were all considered, and he was the sole participant, and he was 100% responsible for the murder. The judge also added that he believed that there would be poor prognosis for rehabilitation and acknowledged the compelling victim statements made earlier this week. That's interesting that the court actually said there's little hope for rehabilitation. Sometimes you would think judges would say that a little more often in such heinous type of cases, which is basically, do not let this person out of prison. Now, the judge noted that this was one of the most difficult cases that he'd had, and it was shocking that he didn't witness his entire 16 years of law practice. Although bad, horrific, I assure you there's even worse out there, Judge. The judge reviled Fucci, saying that his behavior before the murder showed a heightened level of premeditation, and it appeared that he understood the consequences of his actions. It was also described as troubling by the judge, who said there appeared to be no motive for the murder and that it was committed for no other reason but to satisfy the defendant's internal desire to feel what it was like to kill someone. Now, Fucci wrote a letter and said nine times that he apologized to the Bailey family, his own family, and the community for taking the girl's young life. Yeah, he talked about how much he missed doing all those fun things, being with his family, eating particular foods, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Well, Mr. Fucci, you'd get an opportunity to do all that had you not killed an innocent young woman.
Like many Americans, we got a dog during the pandemic. My quarantine dog, Miss Winnie the Bulldog. Now, Miss Winnie has grown accustomed to being around us all the time. When we were leaving the house, Winnie would have extreme anxiety, so we decided to look for natural products to help with her anxiety. We looked for the highest quality CBD treats, and we were not satisfied, and neither was Winnie. So we created a high-quality CBD product that absorbs faster and provides the required results faster. Baked in Colorado, CBD treats and beverage enhancers are made with nanotechnology. The nanotechnology makes the CBD extraction more pure, also allows for Baked in Colorado products to work faster. Baked in Colorado products can help reduce your pet's anxiety, ease joint pain, and help with your dog's skin problems. Go to our online store and see what Baked in Colorado product is best for your dog. When you order at bakedincolorado.com, enter code Winnie and receive 15% off your first order. We have a 30-day money-back guarantee. If your dog does not experience the desired results in 30 days, return the product and we will refund your money. No questions asked.
Next involved, our dumb criminal of the day. Who is he? Forbes March. Does that name sound familiar? Huh, where do I know that name from? He's a former soap opera star. He appeared in All My Children, As the World Turns, One Life to Live, and now he's being accused of stealing, get this, cooking oil from a restaurant. It's reported that Mr. March and a second man, Oscar Guadaro, were arrested earlier this month in upstate New York town called Ulster after being busted outside of a restaurant called Michael's Diner. Police responded to a call on the night of March 2nd about two subjects siphoning used cooking oil from the storage container in the back of the restaurant. The container was said to belong to a company called Buffalo Biodiesel, which collects the cooking grease from eateries in a dozen states, then converts it into biofuels. The biodiesel representative said that there's been a lot of theft of cooking oil because the cost of the fuel has been going up as prices increased everywhere. So why would an ex-soap opera actor need this little commodity? It's unclear, but it's believed that Mr. March owns and runs a firewood delivery company from his farm in the Catskills, and the cooking oil that March and Mr. Guardaro allegedly tried to steal was worth about $1,000. Well, guess what? He didn't get the oil. He's got to get an attorney, and now he's also been hit with a felony charge of grand larceny. Yep. That's dumb for cooking oil. $1,000. Felony conviction. Wow. That's dumb. The stupidity some days never ceases to amaze me. All right. That's all we have for you today. Thanks for watching. We'll see you next time on Crime Talk.